Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars, the show that takes you through every Best Picture nominee from 1927 to today. I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm Ryan.
And I realized in the last few episodes that I've edited that I struggle so hard to say the show that takes you through. I'm always like, the show that takes you. It's so bad. So if at any point we need to switch that. That's why.
To where I say it?
Yeah.
Okay, I could say it. It's funny. I've been listening to the episodes as we've dropped them, and one thing that I thought every time that I've listened to it from episode, zero in episode one, was how natural it sounded and it felt.
Good.
So kudos to you, because I never noticed.
Well, you must not notice the little bead of sweat that drips down the side of my face every time, because I know it's coming, but...
That's hilarious. No, I never noticed. Not even in listening or paying attention to you here in the pod.
Perfect. Thanks for paying attention to me in general, I guess.
Yep. There's that self-worth we talked about.
Hey, we're back with the second year of the Academy Awards, doing a whole new batch of films. Five movies, right?
Yeah, five movies. A little bit of an asterisk on that, right? I mean, five movies that were participating there, but in terms of what we can do some research, a little difficult for our first one that we're going to be talking about. But you're right, first things first, new year, new us, new month, rather new us for you and I. What did you think overall with the 1929 ceremony?
I think those movies hold a special place in my heart, mm-hmm, because of the original run of the show, and just like I spent so much time with those movies years ago, and then now again doing it with you. I've seen those movies more than I've seen some of my favorite movies of the last 10 years.
That sounds like a Stockholm Syndrome type situation.
Maybe a little bit for some of them. But yeah, it's always a good time revisiting those. I am excited to move on, though.
I need to get you on a diet, per se, of every time you watch something from the 1930s, I'm peppering in some like 2000s horror for you to watch.
I need it.
Yeah.
As we're recording this, we're a third of the way through October.
Yikes.
I've watched one horror movie, and I don't think it counts. It's Megan. I mentioned that last week.
Megan 2.0 doesn't count, but Megan counts.
Yeah, it's just...
It's not scary.
I don't want it to count. Well, I'm glad it counts. Yay, horror, but...
I like Megan fine. I think that it's difficult when studios can't fully embrace what people love about her. I will give Blumhouse credit for looking at Megan and saying, what if we did Terminator 2?
Oh, for two.
But they did like a campy version of Terminator 2, and it didn't vibe with me. But one is totally horror, so I think that's fair to say.
Cool.
Not scary, but it is horror.
Exactly 1% of my October has been horror, I guess. Yippee!
That's okay. I mean, you know what's nice about Megan, though, and being able to find all that, is that you can find it.
This is true.
That it is available to
you. It was very easy to find.
Yes.
Almost forced on me.
Almost.
But
thank you, Peacock.
Yeah. You bring up a good point, though. The movie we're talking about today, as best we can, is The Patriot from 1928. Again, this says 28, but earlier I saw 27. When did this movie come out?
Well, I think that it was probably a situation where it was like maybe filmed in 27, but released in 28. But everything that I have seen here does say specifically 1928. So
yeah.
I think we can lean towards that.
That makes sense, too, because it wouldn't have been nominated if it was 27.
Exactly.
Guys, disregard me on this historically influenced podcast.
No, there's a lot of... And that's the thing, is that because it's lost to time, so to speak, there's a lot of misinformation on it, right? There's a lot of, well, is it actually from this time? Did this happen in the movie? Like, thankfully, we have some records of the plot and the synopsis, but there really isn't a ton that's available to us.
Right. And that's really sad to me. It's so wild always to think about a movie that was nominated for the highest achievement, on. You can't watch it.
You know, and if it was, you know, part of the previous ceremony or year where it was a silent film, or if it was just another talkie, okay, there's one out of, like, you know, hundreds that are gone. This actually is the last time that a part talkie is what they call it, right? So silent film for some of it, but then there were portions with that talking aspect that was nominated for an Oscar. So this is literally the last of its kind nominated for an Oscar, and we can't go back and find that. I have some thoughts on things like that, and we'll share it a little further down the road here with this episode, with kind of like the, I think we can call this kind of a half episode, right? Because half we'll be talking about a bit about The Patriot. But the other half, I think we're going to be talking about lost media in general, right?
Absolutely.
The idea of not being able to find or archive some of this, some of these bits of history.
Yeah, because while it is a big problem from the early days of cinema, it's something that still exists today.
Yeah.
There are indie directors and filmmakers that make these things that do well in a festival circuit, and then when the theaters stop playing them, they just toss them.
And there's large streamers that have this content available only under their app and not in physical forms at all. Showing my hand a little bit there, but definitely some things to talk about with that. So talking about The Patriot, this one's interesting because, again, mentioned how it's part talkie, right? That's the term that they used back then. It is a semi-biographical, though, specifically revolving around Count, is it P-A-H-L-E-N? We'll say Pellin.
Yeah.
So Count Pellin's plot to remove the Mad Tsar from the throne. So semi-biographical, part talkie, released by Paramount Pictures and directed by Ernest Lubitsch.
Ernst Lubitsch.
Misread the second E in there to exist. It doesn't. Ernst Lubitsch. Yes, thank you. So I mentioned part talkie, right? The idea is that it's synchronized music, sound effects, but then there are some talking sequences. So we'll see something similar in a film we'll talk about next week, but for the most part, it is considered a part talkie. You know, we'll spoil just a little bit here. I think watching In Old Arizona, there's, I would say maybe 85% of the movie is talking, maybe 90%.
Yeah.
So to me, it didn't even register that there could be something called a part talkie because there's just some scenes that don't have talking in movies. From this description and us not being able to watch it, I'm going to assume this is at least a 50-50 scenario where there are cue cards, maybe, but then some sequences they were able to film with this new technology. Is that kind of how you read it as well?
I don't know, actually. I didn't even think about title cards or anything.
I mean, otherwise, you could say most movies are part talkie, right? Because there's some scenes where people aren't talking and it's just sound and that's sound effects.
Very true. Some talking sequences. Yeah, that's how you say that word.
It's okay. We're even now for Ernest and Ernst.
Yeah, it's because The Jazz Singer, the first sound film, was also a part talkie.
Right. So this isn't the first of its kind, but no. It was the last to be nominated.
Yeah, but I'm curious now because I haven't seen The Jazz Singer, if that would be a good example of if
they're doing it,
you know, with title cards and all that.
Like, I think if you have title cards, but also you have scenes with talking in it, yeah, I think that's part talkie.
You know what? I'm looking at the definition here, Ryan, and it says singing and talking interspersed throughout the film, while the rest is a synchronized film with intertitles.
Yeah, so there you go.
Incredible. I've never seen a part talkie because I had no idea. I didn't even think about title cards while there is the existence of sound in the picture.
Well, it's interesting because I think that we talk about this year and last year. You know, we watched Wings, The Racket, and Seventh Heaven. And then we cut to this year, and it's just feature-length films that feature talking throughout, right? So you don't even think about the hybrid sense of it.
Yeah.
But then you have something like The Jazz Singer, something like The Patriot, seemingly, that does have that, what's the word I'm looking for? It does have that combination, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's still, they're testing that new technology, and they can't do a feature-length version of it. So that's interesting. I never really thought of that before looking this up about The Patriot.
Yeah. That's so bizarre. I need to watch a part talkie now.
Well, unfortunately, with The Patriot, we can't.
Yeah, so. I know, Ryan. You don't have to rub it in.
Sorry. So, let's talk a little bit about the movie itself. So, you mentioned it's directed by Ernst Lubitsch. Is that how you pronounce his last name?
Yeah, Ernst Lubitsch.
Lubitsch, thank you. Written by Hans Crawley, starring Emil Jannings. We talked about Emil last month, for the 1929 ceremony. He had done the Way of the Flesh?
The Way of the Flesh.
Starred in The Way of the Flesh.
The Last Command?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's correct. Florence Vidor, Lewis Stone and Neil Hamilton. So this one, clocking in just under 2 hours, had a budget of $1 million, and it was actually nominated for Best Writing, as well as a couple other categories. Best Writing was probably the biggest one for them, though. So that's the rundown here.
Mm-hmm.
With specifically not being able to see this movie, it's difficult to talk about the movie itself. Right, we've done our research, we've researched the plot here. But the main thing I really wanted to talk about, and the thing that kind of stood out to me, was I was looking to see why this one, right? Because it's in a year, it's sandwiched between a year where there is plenty of movies that are available to us now,
mm-hmm.
and in a year where there's still plenty available to us then. So we can't say it's an age thing, right? It's got to be something with the rights. And I'm wondering why it's not available to us. Not a ton available here to let us know why that might be. Paramount, very prevalent studio, even to today. So it doesn't make a ton of sense why there wouldn't be funding for that sort of preservation. But there was something that I did notice in our research that I kind of wanted to point out to you specifically. It's worth noting that when Kyle and I do our research here, we don't really talk to each other about it first because we want it to kind of be raw for the pod, right? Be authentic. So there is something that I found that I thought was interesting. And it's a description of the end of The Patriot. So at the end of The Patriot, a character named the Countess actually comes to the aid of I believe it was the Count? Is that what
Count
I said?
Count Palin.
Count Palin, thank you. So comes to the aid of the Count and then holds the Count. And the Count then says, dying breath, I have been a bad friend and lover, but I have been a patriot. And then it ends. So I think outside of Jared Leto saying it's Tronning time in the new Tron Ares, that might be one of the most egregious uses of the title for me. I remember when I used to screen movies, Taylor and I saw a movie by Nicholas Sparks called The Best of Me. James Marsden, I'm going to take a shot in the dark and say Michelle Monaghan, I'm not positive. And the last scene is that she's reading a letter that James Marsden wrote her. In a giant garden, she's reading this letter, and the camera's pulling away from her. She's reading it, and you realize that she's happy now or whatever. And she reads in his voice that you will always and forever have the best in me. And like the title card just popped up, the end. And I remember just being so mad.
Really?
Like, there's something about that just feels kind of like a button where it's like, it's not earned.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like it tells you up front, like this is coming. And then when it happens, you're like, gotcha. Like it feels almost like a... Not offensive, but it feels kind of like dangling keys in front of a baby. Like, I don't know.
Do you always feel that way when that happens?
I'm sure you're about to give me an example of something that absolutely is not that.
You see me winding up my arm over here.
I see you ready like, to do the uppercut.
Really? You don't like it, Ryan? Really?
Give me an example of one.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
Yeah, that's true.
I think you've quoted that a few times on the pod.
I have. And like that's not bad because the writing itself isn't bad.
Mm.
Not to say that the Patriots one is bad because maybe the delivery is good. But seeing just the writing of I have been a bad friend and bad lover, but I have indeed been a patriot, just feels a little like, okay. But again, 1928.
You know, that is one of those things where I wonder, though, if it was all written first, and then that was such a great line that they said, let's just call it The Patriot then.
Sure, and that makes sense. I have less confidence in Nicholas Sparks that he wrote that last line. He was like, best of me. It just feels more like that was the name. Like, I almost have a guarantee that was the name of the book, or, you know, it had to be the book for him. The book in the script at the time, and then when he's writing the script, he's like, yeah, let's just Chinatown it. But again, with Chinatown, like, it's the exception to the rule because of how well it's written and the idea of, like, you can't make sense of this world, right? Whereas with the James Marsden one, it's like, I'm still with you. Like, it doesn't have the emotion behind it that something like Chinatown or the chat section, probably comment section probably has five other examples. If Inception ends with the word Inception, I'll eat my hat. But I'm pretty positive it doesn't.
I wonder what the last line for Inception is. I don't know.
I think it might actually be like kids or dad.
Yeah, something like that.
Because then everyone just leaves the frame whenever that happens.
Yeah. I don't even know if that last line you're talking about is spoken or it's a title card.
It's a good point.
There's no way of knowing.
There's no way of knowing with it being part talkie what was not included or not. However, I would hope that if they were able to film some of it, that the dying breath line would be included in that. But, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, it's important to note that with this being the first year that talkies were really in the picture, that there was still a lot of technology to work out, right? And that's clear throughout watching these movies. Not one of them is perfect with its sound design because they're still working that out. To a point where it's actually kind of surprising that there wasn't a in-between year of just part talkies, right? Of, well, let's do it where we can, but obviously we can't do a full feature length. Now, they did it pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how they're still trying to figure out this technology in real time. Whether that results in something being a part talkie or results in something you've quoted many times on this pod, standing still in one place so you can make sure that the mic is actually picking you up.
Right.
Kind of limiting your physical performance in that sense. So they are still very much figuring that out. But it's just a bummer, man. It's unfortunate that we can't go back and watch this kind of content. Like, that it's not available. This level of artwork isn't available to us.
Yeah, and I think, like, a director like Ernst Lubitsch, he's been nominated a few times by the Academy. He's a very prestigious director. There's good stuff that he's putting out later on. And I don't know about you, but I love watching like a modern director and seeing their biggest movie and then going back and watching like the short films they put out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just to see where they came from, to see how their style and everything evolved. That's kind of like why we're doing the show the way we are in linear order. You can't do that with Ernst Lubitsch now. You can't go back and see not only his earlier work, but his earlier work that was nominated for Best Picture. That's crazy.
Yeah, I'll tell you some people that are fun to do that for. Christopher Nolan going back and watching like Following is very interesting, especially like everyone's seen Inception, Interstellar, Dark Knight. Watching how he kind of captures those tones through something like Following is really great. And kudos for Criterion for having that Blu-ray edition available to us, right? Another one is David Sandberg. Like David Sandberg went on to do Lights Out, the Shazam movies, which we don't want to talk about. And Until Dawn, which we equally probably don't want to talk about, but he had a short called Lights Out, and he's done a lot of horror shorts in that sense, and it's very interesting to watch like his kind of form and his structure exist in these shorts, and then go on to the feature length. The one person I wouldn't suggest doing that for is Ari Aster. I think it's smart to leave Ari Aster's shorts where they are.
Yeah.
Mostly just because, I will say, if you need to get a true sense of who someone is and what their movies are going to be like, watching his shorts is a very good way of doing that. I'm not sure if you're familiar with many of his shorts, but they're out there.
Yeah. It's so weird. I feel like if you would have watched Hereditary and then gone back and watched his shorts to see where he came from,
yeah,
you would be less shocked when Beau is Afraid comes out.
Yeah. No, I mean, well, Beau is Afraid was something he did previously, right? It was a short of his.
Yeah.
So if anything, it was like not so much a remake, but an extension. Because obviously it wasn't the 2.5 hours woof that Beau is Afraid
right.
feature like this. But yes, the importance there being that you have the full scale of the work, the full scope of the work available to you to go back and see what inspired them, what got them into it. Something that I thought was really interesting was I was watching that interview that Paul Thomas Anderson did with Charlie Rose, I think, a while back, where he said that he quit film school. Because the teacher on the first day, the professor, had said, if you're here to make Terminator 2, just go ahead and leave, right? Kind of dogging on the idea of making any kind of like fanfare movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he at the time was just like, thought that was so unfair, right? Like, what if someone here does want to make Terminator 2? Like, you're completely excluding them from it. And that was kind of like the beginning of him not really feeling in place at a film school. So he goes on to do whatever he wants to there. That, to me, was kind of the idea of, like, you now have this full scale of this person's work. Like, you know, like, you, when you watch something like Hard Eight or Boogie Nights or Magnolia, you're not thinking about Terminator 2.
Right.
But that is something that exists in his world, like, the meaning of that. So having the research available to us, A, is one thing, which I'm grateful that we have the research here for this movie. But being able to go and watch these things and see what inspired them, see how they started out, see where they've gone, it's really important for things like this. And it's, again, I think some people see movies just as entertainment. And they are. But there's a history behind it. And that history is being lost. And we'll get to it in a little bit here. I think we're kind of heading in the direction where we're not going to see much of a change in that with the way that we're storing the films and the TV shows and the documents that are available to us now.
Do you say we're not going to see much change, or we are going to see?
I want to be hopeful.
Yeah.
But I think that the Netflix of it all, I think that that makes it to where it's very difficult to get your hands on some of this.
Yeah.
A peek under the hood, you know, a perfect example is when Stranger Things came out, and it was a phenomenon back when it was, that they released the first and second season on DVD and Blu-ray, but they only released it in like a, the box set was meant to represent like a old school 1980s, 1990s VHS tape. And like you were supposed to open like a clamshell and all that fun stuff. And it was even worn on the outside. I think it had like a green horror sticker at the top, like an old rental or video rental place. So they were making physical media of this for you to store and hold on to. And whether it's a box set like that, or it's just the actual literal DVDs and Blu-ray discs inside of just a small thing of plastic. Okay, you're still making it available to people. But then at some point, they were like, well, we don't want to do that for 3 or 4. And I don't think they're going to do it for 5 coming up.
Right.
They made Glass Onion, Rian Johnson's follow-up to Glass Onion, or sorry, to Knives Out. And that's not available, right? There's
as physical media.
As physical media. And you can't get it outside of that. Now, granted, these are Netflix exclusives, and they are staying on their app for now.
Yeah.
But there's content that they've made that they've then removed. And great, okay, you removed it. At least I have it on physical. Oh, you never released it on physical. So now they're making so much that it actually, seemingly by their logic, is too expensive to go and make the physical versions of that. So they just take it off the site. So it's quite literally creating just to then remove it when you don't want to store it anymore.
Yeah.
And that's dangerous because then you're seeing it as a product. You're seeing it as, and it is a product, but you're not seeing the artistry behind it and you're not trying to preserve it. And to me, it just seems so easy. I am a snob. I want, if you show me a DVD and a Blu-ray of the same thing, I'm basically stepping on the DVD. Like, just give me the Blu-ray. But if you give me just the DVD, like, hey, it's expensive to make Blu-rays, here's the DVD of it. Fine. Okay, I'm going to get that because that's the only thing that's available. I want the higher definition, but okay. But they're not doing anything like that.
Yeah.
And that's just such a bummer to me because you see such big names. We have a Del Toro monster movie, Frankenstein, coming out this year. And I'm worried that I'm not going to be able to own that, right? Because yeah. I would love to have a complete Del Toro collection. Can't do it. Now, based on the reviews, maybe won't be a big concern. But it's still Del Toro.
Right.
Like one of the biggest names in horror, if not just movies in general. And it's a bummer that like we can't go and do that stuff. So the reason I say that I feel like that change isn't really going to happen anytime soon is because Netflix is seen as like, oh, well, it's just so easy to have and there's so much on there and it's just like the streamer that you need to have. But they're the ones that are pushing that level of not having physical media. Don't get me wrong. Prime Video isn't necessarily releasing all of their stuff on physical as well. They're doing a better job, but not quite everything. Hulu in a similar place. Shudder is doing pretty fantastic work.
Yeah.
They've released all their VHSs. Oddity, when that came out, that was available pretty quickly. You can get a majority of their stuff. Not everything, but a majority. And they try to put it in theaters.
I mean, that's probably because they know their fan base, too.
Sure. I mean,
horror people are collectors.
Case in point. So, absolutely. And they're putting it in theaters. Netflix tries to do that sometimes, mostly when they get bullied into it, is what it feels like.
Or when they want the Oscar.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, oh, do you want a Del Toro movie in theaters? Fine.
Yeah, Scorsese.
Bradley Cooper doing a follow-up to A Star Is Born where he won the Oscars. I guess we'll put it in theaters.
Right.
Like, it just, it feels very much like, it's intentional. It doesn't feel like it's just an accidental, oh, we're not holding the preservation of these movies. It just feels like too big to fail. Like, mm-hmm. We're just, who cares? What are you going to do, not have Netflix anymore? So, Old Guy Yells at Cloud, wrapping up on this, that's why I feel like the idea of preservation and the importance of this isn't being followed when, like, the largest streaming platform that exists right now isn't contributing to that.
Yeah.
Right? So, I'm a little hesitant about it, but I say all of that to say, I really should have worn my physical media forever hoodie today. I say all that to say, when you like something, go out and buy it. Right? If you rented it for $5 and you really enjoyed it, find the $15, wait till it's on sale, find that DVD, Blu-ray, 4K, whatever it is, it's your preference, and support it, because we're seeing Target and Walmart, to a certain extent, major chains that are no longer carrying these physical media, DVD, Blu-ray, 4K, otherwise. We're not seeing that anymore. And you can still get it online. So go to your Blu-ray.com, go to Vinegar Syndrome, go to Arrow, go to Umbrella. Go to a lot of these companies and seek them out that are doing really great work in restoration, preservation, releasing these movies in premium formats available to you so you can go and buy them and keep them and have them available to you so you can go back and say, look at this thing. Isn't it cool that even though this movie is like maybe a 6 out of 10 for me, that like it was the last Part Talkie that was nominated for an Oscar? Like, isn't that a cool bit of history?
Yeah.
And for some people, that probably sounds like the most boring episode of American Pickers or whatever you watch on the History Channel. Great show, by the way. I don't know if that seems like super obvious to me, but like American Pickers is one of my favorite shows of all. If I'm on vacation and American Pickers is on, whatever plans I had for that day, it's done. I'm it's watching over. American Pickers on vacation.
Damn.
It's so good. We'll talk about that off pod. But that's where I stand on it, man. That's why I love physical media so much. Isn't just because I like having something and kind of being like, you know, do this. And I do like letting people borrow stuff. I like being a library. I can't remember if I said it on pod or not, but I remember I told you I went over to my buddy's house last week. Went to my buddy's house last week to watch VHS Halloween, co-sign, and he had built an area for his Blu-rays above this door. And it looks really great. And at the right side of it, he was like, oh, by the way, there's the movies that you let me borrow. There's like 6 Blu-rays. And I was like, I thought I had let you one. Like, how do you have 6 of mine? And I wasn't even mad. It was just kind of like, I have now gotten to the point where my library, I haven't missed them. Like, I haven't thought that I was missing those 6. But, like, this is one guy I let borrow my Blu-rays. I've let a couple other people borrow Blu-rays, too. So, the one thing of that is, you know, be the library for your friends and let them borrow your stuff. But also, maybe start a registry.
Yeah. Dewey Decimal it up and... You know, keep track of your stuff.
Yeah, and maybe I start, like, calling him every 2 weeks and being like, hey, just a reminder, you have my copy of The Fall that I need back.
Yeah. So film preservation is important even for the personal aspect of it.
Absolutely. Although I understand why he still has The Fall. His wife, shout out to Lauren, his wife has, have you seen those t-shirts that are, like, it's like 4 or 5 different versions of Pedro Pascal, and it'll say Pedro across the top and, like, bright neon font?
No, but
almost
I
like
just,
Three Wolf Moon.
Right. I just painted it in my head.
You painted in your head. Yeah. Okay, you got it. She has that, but it's Lee Pace.
Okay.
And it just says Lee Pace, and it has like 5 different versions of Lee Pace on it. And just shout out to her that she is being a real one like that.
Yeah.
That's a great shirt. But yes, it's important for you as well, just to have your physical media in your collection. Because God forbid, you know, if they ever decide to take Stranger Things off because it's not doing well for them anymore in like 10 years... I have that first, the first season. I have the first 2 seasons that I can go back and watch. And maybe that's the best way to remember Stranger Things is that first season. But still, you have that available to where you can share that with people.
Yeah.
And be like, hey, check this out.
Well, you know, the interesting thing too is there's the potential of it being removed in the future. But then there's also what happens now where things can be updated and changed. You have, I recently rewatched Stranger Things to get ready for the 5th season. And I noticed that the clock chime that Vecna plays every time he shows up,
yeah,
they added that to scenes in the 1st and 2nd seasons.
Really?
Yeah, when Will first falls off his bike in the first episode while he's running from the Demogorgon, they added in one of those Vecna chimes to kind of foreshadow Vecna in later seasons. Because they were like, oh, this was a good idea. Wish we would have thought of it then. And now you can do that with digital media and things like that. But it sucks. I don't like it. And like, it fits really well. While I was watching, I was like, wow, that's so cool. But then when I learned that it was added in, like, ultra post, that it just, it takes away from the original art form, you know? And that's something just like Star Wars.
Whatever could you mean?
Right? It's wild. That is a form of lost media, in a sense.
Yeah.
Unless you go out and you find the VHS tapes, you can't watch the original George Lucas versions. You can watch the new George Lucas versions.
Well, one of the 12.
Right.
Yeah, so let's go back to Stranger Things real quick, because I think that's an interesting thing. You know, I think that directors should have the ability to go back and update things that they maybe thought was like a bit more, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? They should be able to update as they see needed based on the technology that becomes available to them, right? So let's say hypothetically you're 1970s. Like mm-hmm. if you make a film in the 1970s and then in the 2000s when you're making like a 4K, you're like, wow, wouldn't it be interesting if like we actually changed this up a little bit where like maybe this looked a little different or this was different based on what's available to you now? That's interesting if it's a separate edition. Right. So you sure. have your original edition and then you have the updated 4K and you can see the director's, you know, intended version or whatever it might be. But when you're going and you're replacing what existed before with an updated thing, and I agree with you, I think the idea, if it was done from execution, that like Vecna's clock is kind of ticking from the very beginning and we don't know his existence until like the third or fourth season.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And that's super cool. And that reminds me a little bit of like the early stages of Marvel, the MCU. And how they had this plan laid out and they kind of like planted the seeds and then gave you exactly that. And it's a great payoff. And I imagine people who are watching Stranger Things for the first time with that updated change are going to see that and be like, wow, what a great payoff. Unfortunately, we were watching at a time where that payoff didn't exist. And it really is now just like hindsight. Hey, wouldn't it be cool if?
Yeah.
That's a scenario where I am extremely glad that I have the first season and second season on Blu-ray to where I can go back and watch the original version and not have to worry so much about a clock tick. Now, is it just an audio thing that's put in there to kind of make you think of Vecna in the future? Sure. Not that big of a deal at the end of the day. But Star Wars is a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's just entire scenes, entire like puppets that existed back then. And now it's a CGI Jabba the Hutt.
Right.
And technically, does it look a little bit more updated to today's standards? Sure. But that's not how it originally looked. And people fell in love with Star Wars back then because of how it originally looked.
Yeah.
So to me, I think updating things is completely fine. But you want to have the original versions, right? You should have those versions available to you. That's what's kind of confusing about Star Wars is it's not, oh, hey, this is the version we're using right now. There's like 15 versions you can watch right now, but not one of them is the original. And that to me feels offensive.
Like, yeah, you
should,
I agree.
It's a shame. You should be able to go and watch the original version. If we can go and watch some of the movies that we've been watching for this and some other movies that exist on Tubi from this time and they exist with their faults, why shouldn't that? And it's not even a fault. It's just the director's preference or the studio's preference, whoever it might be. I'm actually not sure. But it's art. It's frustrating.
Yeah, 100%. And it's so interesting to me to think like the original versions of Star Wars, since they never existed on digital media, like
correct.
They stopped at the VHS. Now you can go and you can watch those versions like on YouTube and stuff or somewhere on the internet. Who digitized those? Was it the studio? Or are all of those versions available on the internet because someone with a VHS player and the right cables digitized it themselves and made it widely available?
I don't know for certain. It's probably the latter. Because otherwise, you better believe that I tried to make sure this was a PG podcast. You can believe the fact that if the studio was behind digitizing that and changing that information, they would have profited off it immediately.
Exactly.
So there would be a DVD Blu-ray of that.
And that's what's so wild is that now even some of the biggest movies and versions of these movies of all time are being saved from a preservation standpoint by people like you and me and not these massive studios. Netflix is pulling off really creative and unique things like Bandersnatch, getting rid of it completely. And the only reason that is available now to people is because of just regular old Joes mm-hmm. like you and me. Back in the 20s and up to like the 70s, when films were lost, they were actually physically lost. It was either because the studio mishandled them, which you could argue is the equivalent of what Netflix and other production studios and streaming services are doing now.
Absolutely.
Or, I mean, there were tragedies. There were fires. Film was made on potassium nitrate, highly flammable. You had to keep it at like 70 degrees or lower, I think. So that stuff was always going up in flames. And it was all stored together. So if you had one go, there goes all of, I don't know, MGM's entire collection of these films. You don't really have that now.
You have versions of that. I mean, I think that there will always be the next step in something, right? I mean, we were writing everything on paper and then we learned that we could type. And then we learned from typing on like typing physically that we could go to a computer and start typing on there now via keyboard instead of a typewriter.
Yeah.
Right. So there's always that next level step of, well, hey, I have everything written down. Why don't I just go ahead and use this typewriter? Well, I have everything typed out. Why don't I just go ahead and fax this and put it on my computer? Well, why don't I go ahead and type this out now in my Word document and have this preserved? So you're preserving that, right?
Right.
There's always a step of that to where, yes, we were using film on like potassium nitrate, but now we have the ability to kind of like convert that into something else that is less flammable. And there should be a system put in place. I mean, you know, perfect world here. There should be a system put in place to kind of take everything that did exist previously and update it to the next, especially when there's like a historical aspect behind it. Every film from 1929, probably not. Every film from any year, probably not possible to do that. But especially one that's nominated for everything that this was nominated for. That just seems like a real shame.
Yeah. And there are other movies. If we would have done this show 15, 20 years ago, there would have been a lot more than just this one Best Picture nominee that we wouldn't have been able to find.
Sure.
There are things that have popped up. The Racket, actually. I believe we mentioned that was a lost film until like 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And it was found in Howard Hughes' private collection. That's wild. That means that in the entire world, this film that was nominated for the highest award at the Academy Awards was gone, except hiding in this guy's closet. You know, and this guy obviously is someone that would have this level of film, but it's still like, imagine, you know what I say, imagine. I was reading about all of these different stories earlier today. People are hopping on eBay and just going, old film, nitrate film, blah, blah, blah. And they find like a film canister, get it home, and they're like, oh my God, I just paid $5 for a movie from like 1931 that's been lost forever. And it's just somebody had it.
No, but they don't know what they have.
Yeah, and they don't know what it is. They're just like, oh, I got this film canister. That's cool. Pop it on eBay, $5. And then that's insane to me.
Yeah.
Absolutely insane. Did you hear the story? This isn't about film, but it is about data, because I mentioned fires and, you know, we don't really have that now. We absolutely do.
For sure.
We still have, you know, different ways to store media and data and all of that, but fire is always an issue. We still have the issue of you know, servers crashing and that kind of thing and losing all of this. In South Korea, there was a data center fire and it took out like 33% of the government's data. And it wouldn't.
What are we doing with that anyways right now? That's fine.
Sure.
At this point.
It wouldn't have been a big deal. Do you know where they stored the backups?
Don't tell me Rome.
The same room. Same room.
The backups were in the same location?
Just, yeah, kept right next door. So from what I read earlier, studios, I can't speak for all of them, but I had read that like Paramount was really making leaps and bounds to try and preserve old film and current film. They have their data centers that store all of the digital media, and there are backups upon backups, and their film canisters, the nitrate film canisters, are kept in a separate room that is like climate controlled and really, really just, they're taking care of these things.
Right.
In a way that they did not do in the past. And Paramount was one of these studios that had a fire. I think every major studio at some time in their history had some kind of fire. And that's a huge reason we lost so many of these films.
Well, I mean, it's a perfect example for this. You know, it's not really cited why The Patriot doesn't have footage that exists at this time. But in terms of what's available right now, I mean, it's only pieces, right? There's trailers that you can go and see The Patriot. And we, Kyle and I both recommend that you do so to watch in preparation for this podcast and just to celebrate this year of the Oscars with us. But it's the Film and Television Archive of UCLA actually currently has about 25%, a quarter of the footage of The Patriot. And then there's one reel that was found in Portugal. And you had mentioned that a reel back then was probably about 15 minutes.
I think so, yeah.
Roughly about anywhere, 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah, 10, 15, 20.
So, and here's the thing, is that the movie is about 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So even then, that's less than what the UCLA archive currently has. So at most, one specific location and group has about 25% of this movie.
Right.
And that's a shame. I mean, there's no, to date, any copy that's complete of this. So it is, in fact, and this is what's kind of nuts to me, the only Best Picture Academy Award nominee for which there is not a complete copy.
Right.
Or near complete copy. So it is important that we have an episode about this, even if we can't find it, because it is kind of the one lone wolf of this and one example of how it is a shame. You know, at the end of the day, is it going to bum anyone out that they can't go back and watch this movie from 1929 that was nominated and won for some awards? We'll get there. Probably not. You know, my parents are never going to worry about this. Taylor's never going to worry about this. But
I'm worried.
I'm worried about it. I'm with you on that. Like, there's, you know, I should say this. There is good progress being made. Kyle is correct that there are companies that are very much trying to preserve film as they can, and Paramount is doing a great work of it. Here's the good news. Paramount is the studio that released this film. So there is a good chance that in the future, if there is a copy of this that exists or footage they can put together, they're going to find that. You know, even if there's footage without like the talkie sequences and they can find, you know, just the footage itself and not the audio. Guess what? You already have part talkie on it with cue cards. Why don't we just make more cue cards? And yeah, that is updating the film. But if there's nothing else previously, at least there is a version of the film that we can see. It was remade in 1938 with the same name, but this original version and all of its nominations don't have anything physical to show for it. So, I started this off positive and I went a little more negative. The positive thing here is that there are acts being made. There are efforts being put in to preserve film more and more every day. Again, you want to support the companies that have done this in the past. You know, Arrow does a great job. I mentioned Vinegar Syndrome. I mentioned Umbrella. There's a number of others. I'm missing hundreds, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But go out, search the movies that you like, pick them up where you can, and make sure that you are supporting, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, chances are you are a fan of movies. So make sure that you're preserving the way that you can and supporting the way that you can for the movies that you love. Because that's ultimately, money is going to be the thing that makes studios realize whether or not they should focus on these levels of importance.
Right. And to add to that, we talk about it all the time, going to see movies in theaters.
Absolutely.
I brought it up briefly earlier. These indie directors that go and they make their beloved horror movies that they put all of this effort into, they go and they do a couple festivals, they play it, and it does well, but not well enough to get picked up. Sometimes these movies, they literally just toss them out. They're like, all right, well, I made that. Or, you know, storing tons and tons of movies at the Paramount Studios is one thing, and they put in all the effort to preserve those. I don't know about you, but when I have something that I'm saving digitally, I've got like my one server and maybe a backup. If something happens at my house or to my server, that's it. It's gone. It's all gone.
Yeah.
That happens with a lot of these indie directors. And then these movies that you may go see at a festival and really enjoy, they're just completely gone. So this is something that happens today, every day. Still, you're losing all of this media, and it's not at the hands of these giant studios who are just pulling it off and teasing you and saying, oh, we might release it on physical, we might not. If you go and you see these movies and you show support for these small filmmakers, that's how these movies get a wider release. That's how there's a better chance of preserving these films. So really, what we're saying is go see movies.
Yeah.
Go buy movies. Movies, movies, movies.
Like, yeah, movies, movies.
That's the way
that
to do it.
That could be the tagline of the podcast, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Criterion. Criterion is doing some great work, too, in terms of not just physically, but also on the, they have a streaming channel that you can go and watch the content of their, I hate calling it product and content, but like the movies that they put out there, right? So there is a lot that you can do with Criterion as well. So there's light on the horizon. There are people who are out there doing the good work to preserve these things. But I think sometimes it's very easy for us just to think, okay, well, it's older, so, you know, we can't do that. And Kyle and I are not releasing this episode because we're bummed out that we couldn't watch this, you know, one movie of all of the hundreds that we're going to watch for this podcast. It's a shame, but that's not the start of it. The start of it really was me getting into physical media. I mentioned on episode zero, I started working at Blockbuster and then Movie Stop. And that was the beginning of me realizing that you could hold on to these things. You could physically have, you know, your letterbox top four. I got my top 1,000 in my house. Like, they're there, ready to be seen. And, like, we can watch them, and we can share them, and I can rent them out to people. And it's so much fun. And the horror marathon that we're doing in a couple weeks, like, that's something that Chase and I put a lot of, you know, pride in, that we can own a lot of these things and pop the disc in, right? We don't have to worry, okay, where is it streaming? Okay, what version is streaming? Is it the dub version or the English version? No, it's just the Blu-ray. And you can choose all of those things available to you because you have it.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a romantic nature behind being able to keep these things and have this available to you. And unfortunately, the more the more that we rely on streamers and corporations to just have it available so we don't need to worry about that on our side, the more that we're going to be seeing something like The Patriot, where it's lost media to us and now we can't go back and find that. So
yeah,
watch your movies, see your movies, buy your movies. And even if it's like the top 10 movies that you like the most, that's okay. Just make sure that you're buying that when you can. So you're showing to the people, the companies that are putting these out, that you do have an interest in these things.
Yeah.
Because that's ultimately what's going to get them to focus more on the preservation.
Absolutely. This is a question that you might not have an answer to. Can you think of anything from your childhood or your young adult years that you would consider lost media that you wish you could bring back?
You know, there is a movie that Taylor had mentioned to me when I started working at Movie Stop. And she said, there's a movie that I watched on TV all the time, and it was called Dropping Off and Picking Up, something like that. And, I mean, she must have mentioned that to me in 2011. It's 2025, and for the past 14 years, wherever I am, if it's Second and Charles, CD Warehouse, McKay, a Walmart, regardless, if there's older content, like older DVDs and everything, I'm looking for that. Because it's something that she mentioned that meant a lot to her back then. Mm-hmm. And I don't know anything about this movie. I know that it's probably called Dropping Off or Picking Up and Dropping Off. I don't know. But that's what I'm looking for. So there's things like that. You know, there's a movie that Tim and I, my brother, used to watch all the time called House Arrest. I believe Kevin Pollak is the lead in it. Carpool is another one. Okay, let's take down the word cinema and go just right down to entertainment at this point. Slappy and the Stinkers is a movie that my brother and I used to watch all the time, and it's literally the little rascals, but what if we gave them a sea lion? And that's Slappy and the Stinkers. Yeah. Garbage now, I'm sure, but so much fun at the time and something we would want to keep for memories. I can't get that on DVD.
Yeah.
I think I have House Arrest on DVD at my house, but I'm not even fully positive of that. Carpool, I may have seen one DVD at one point, but it's so hard to find now. So even if these things existed, and that's the other side of this, there are probably physical editions of some of these movies that we've talked about, but are they available? Are there, like, they're not distributing these anymore, and I understand that, but now there's probably like 100 copies of this thing that exist in the world. Where can I get my hands on it?
Right.
So there are things like that. Would I love a 4K remaster of The Warriors of Virtue? Sure. Like, there's a lot of movies growing up that I loved that just aren't available to us anymore. So I'm glad that some things have stood the test of time. You know, I have a 4K steelbook at home of Small Soldiers, like one of my favorite movies as a kid. And I'm sure absolutely not fueling my love for Gremlins as much as it does.
Right.
But I'm sure there's so much. I'm sure there's so much that not just as a kid that I was into, but that I've probably watched getting a little bit older that I just can't have access to as much. Maybe we've seen it on TV. Maybe it was something that we saw at like a friend's house. But it's just, those are probably the ones for me the most that it's just, I've seen and felt the emotion of not being able to have that.
Right.
And I really do want it because it does feel like, much like your top four, this is kind of who I am. If I make a movie, I don't want it to be anything like Carpool. But Carpool is kind of what got me into like comedies and movies, right? So there's a lot like that. I mean, is there anything that kind of sticks out to you?
You know, I was trying to think of a movie in general. I know for a long time in my late teens, I was really trying to watch Song of the South.
Yeah.
Just because it was kind of, it has the reputation it does of Disney banned it. And I'm like, oh, well, I need to see it then because that's what you do as a kid.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I'm not supposed to give it to
your own movie, then there's probably a reason for it.
Right. Still haven't seen it. I've seen like bootleg copies of it sold at conventions and things like that.
Right. I think that's probably the number one way to see it these days.
Yeah. But I actually think a lot about weird television segments that I watched as a kid.
Oh, sure.
That are completely gone. And that maybe that's stuff that we're just like, well, does that need to be preserved? You know, like this weird interstitial thing that they put between episodes of the Brady Bunch for like one week on Nick at Night. I don't know, but I think about that all the time. There was like a Brady Bunch, like the Canadians in South Park, the way they talked. Mm-hmm. They did that with the Bradys.
With during like the heads going off of their mouths?
Yeah.
Okay.
During like Brady Week or something. And I think about that all the time.
Mm.
I'll never see that again. Ever.
you kind of just opened up a can of worms here talking about TV, because, I mean, like, again, we're going to be talking about stuff that, like, you know, we watched as kids, because that's probably what's not available to us now. PBS was on all the time when I was at after school. Mm-hmm. And, like, Zoom. Did you ever watch Zoom on PBS?
I think so.
Basically a show that kind of posited the idea, what if we put 9 kids in a room and let them do, like, crafts and, like, weird, like, you know, activities, and they filmed it and basically showed, like, this is what, like, not colors are, but, like, science and math and history.
That's not Battle Royale?
That's not Battle Royale. Oh, no, okay. It's a little different. Gotcha. A little less blood than Battle Royale. Okay. A little more English than Battle Royale, too. High Hunger Games. So, Zoom is educational at the end of the day, but it was really fun. It was something I know Taylor has a big affinity for as well. That's not available to us. That's something we can go and watch. And you said something there where you were like, you know, is it something that people probably want to preserve? Probably not. I mean, we should probably be preserving a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I think what would be really cool, and I'm, don't quote me on this. Thankfully, we're not recording. So I think I would love if they made, like, a Blu-ray of, like, 1980 to 1989 commercials. Mm. And, like, here's just all the commercials that existed back then, and you just play it. And you could do that on YouTube right now. You can go and look at, like, you know, hey, what are the commercials that played on Nickelodeon from 2000 to 2005? And then they just kind of pop it on. I think we should have a preservation of a lot of those things. And you brought up, you know, fires still exist. Look at the California wildfires that happened recently.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure a lot of that, a lot of the film reels, data, any of that, existed in California near where they were filming all of that in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's scary to think that it would only exist there, and now it's kind of lost. You know, people lost their houses, people lost their lives. A lot can be lost in these fires. So in the same way that we have insurance on these houses, in the same way that, like, we go to, like, and protect ourselves from these damages as much as possible, we should be protecting our history as well. And that's the history major in me coming out, but ultimately we should be putting that kind of, like, conservation towards it. So that's my main thing, and that's why I kind of got giddy when I saw that you had put on the document here that you wanted to talk about lost footage and lost media in retrospect to the Patriot, because it's a shame that we don't have as much access to this stuff as we could. And, you know, do I love that this is probably the snowball effect of why I had to watch Seventh Heaven with the incorrect score?
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
I'm sure that's a part of it.
I wonder when we'll stop talking about that.
It won't be for a while.
I hope it's not for a while.
Once we start watching more and more talkies, maybe I'll forget about it, but worse.
I'll remind you.
People don't forget. It leads to the point, right? Because then there's not one true edition that exists that's available that you can just put on streaming and then also have it on physical. It is that there's multiple versions, and now we have to be cautious of which version we're watching. So there's a lot to it, and I can go on for about 2 more hours, but the point is that it's an important thing, and I hope that people recognize that too, much like you and I have talked about here. So hopefully it does become less of a problem, but I'm not sure.
Wow. You know, you just said cautious of the version you watch, and we don't have to get into a huge rabbit hole real quick, but I do want to mention this before we wrap up. They just released Sora 2.
Yeah.
If you haven't guessed already, I am very against the development of AI and the use of AI. I don't like any of it. It stresses me out. When I worked in the film industry, that kind of, like, the way it loomed over everything was terrifying. And I was just a background actor, and I was like, they're going to take my one job. So I can't imagine what it's like for all of the other people in the industry. But you mentioned being cautious of the version you watch, and I think that's something that's very important now, kind of in every aspect of what we're viewing. I feel like I've already seen random videos show up on TikTok of, like, Martin Luther King saying things that obviously he would never say, because he's talking about modern things. And we're kind of in an era where there is a huge potential for our history to be rewritten. Maybe not in, like, a solid permanent way, but in a way where if enough people see something that is incorrect and false, it starts to become true, or at least believed to be true. And while obviously that's a huge issue when it comes to, you know, real life things, like seeing Martin Luther King say things that he never would have said, or anybody else, any politician or any regular Joe, anybody really, when you start twisting words and getting people to say and do things that they never would, it's very, very dangerous. But this will also affect our media, the film that we've had for years and years. That's going to start to change as well. You're going to see, I don't know, the end of Chinatown is going to be changed. The end of The Shining will be changed, all because somebody punched into a prompt. You know, Jack Torrance lives and he actually takes everybody out. Boom. And I don't know, enough people see that scrolling through social media and they just accept that as the true ending or whatever.
Or they haven't seen The Shining before, so they're just like, that's the end.
Yeah, now I don't need to watch it. That kind of thing. And, you know, it sounds minor, like, okay, so what? A few people think they know how The Shining ends, but they don't. But I think this has the potential to be incredibly damaging. And again, this isn't talking about, like, putting words into the mouths of politicians or anything. This is strictly a discussion about changing movies that we know, movies that exist. You'll have things that are so much worse than the new versions of Star Wars coming out of this. And I think it's really dangerous, and in a way, probably over the next 5 years or so, going to be one of the most dangerous and possible ways that preservation is going to be, like, I don't know, coming for our movies, you know?
I mean, you're correct, and to, you know, consolidate probably an hour-long conversation into, like, 90 seconds, I firmly believe that AI is very helpful in an enhancement sense and not in a creation sense.
Sure.
I think that creation gets a little difficult. It gets a little hairy, much to your point, of now replicating things with a different, if not wrong, sense. You know, hey, he dies at the end of The Shining. Well, he's alive in this version. Like, it's just doing the complete opposite just because he can. And I think that that gets to be very dicey in terms of who has control of that, because the answer is everyone.
Yeah.
And when everyone has control of that, that then makes it to where everyone is powerful with this sense. And that's dangerous, because there are, I mean, God, I can't imagine being 13 and you give me that level of power that I can create something on generative AI. Like, that was...
It's insane.
You would have seen the most abominable things. Like, the cast of Rugrats versus the cast of Recess just to have an all-out war.
Battle Royale.
Battle Royale between the Rugrats and the Recess kids. And yes, I'm aware the Recess kids would win, age advantage. But the point is that I would be doing the dumbest stuff because I'm 13 and I don't know any better. So when you have kids who are playing Fortnite now and you give them the ability to use generative AI or anything like that, it results in what you're talking about, where it's just like almost Mad Libs. Like, in the span of 90 seconds, I've thought about 5 words and I'm just going to mash them together and then make this thing.
Yeah.
And it's strange because people aren't drawing. People aren't painting. People aren't, like, creating in that sense, because now they can rely on that. AI is super helpful with enhancement, and it's very helpful as a guiding hand. When we give it the ability to create, that gets dangerous to me. So the idea of big studios saying, like, you know, well, hey, maybe it could, like, create a movie, or maybe there's, like, AI superstars or something. I don't know this person, the computation's name, but there's, like, an AI actress.
Tilly Norwood.
Is it Tilly Norwood?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, great. So the Tilly Norwoods of it all. It all feels kind of dystopian in that sense. When you have actors right in front of you, when you have directors right in front of you, who want to make these movies and these art, the passions and the projects that they want to make. So let them do it. Like, yeah, it's cheaper, but, like, there are resources that are being used up for these things, to where when there's people who want to do this thing for you for a similar cost, if not a little bit more, isn't it nice to have the human touch behind it?
Yeah.
The flaws and all of it, doesn't that make it feel a little more human? So that's my stance on it. I'm not saying I'm anti-AI overall, but I am very much cautious of the gen AI.
Yeah, I guess I should clarify it, like...
Not that it's important to have a stance on big AI at this point.
Right, right. The generative and a lot of the visual, and I think just the lack of regulation on AI and the potential of, boy, there could be a video tomorrow of you and me doing whatever, you know?
Well, depending on when this comes out, that might be real.
See, and that's kind of what I'm talking about. I don't like the generative AI, and I don't like the... lack of regulation across the board of it. But I also agree that there is a lot of use for certain forms of AI. But yeah, it's just it's a little nerve-wracking on, I think, what it'll, the effect it'll have on, obviously, future film, but it, for this episode specifically, how it could rewrite the history in the form of film.
This is a really good opportunity that we took here. Very well timed. If you and I had actually planned to like go outside and like ride shopping carts down a highway, that video comes out, and we're gonna be like, well, actually, if you go back and listen to the podcast we just did, we warned you that something like this would happen.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, it's fake. Right. So it was really smart of us to put this out right before we'd like to do all this insane stuff.
So if you see something weird, you know, it's AI.
Hopefully it's as innocent as riding shopping carts down a highway. And nothing more than that. But it's a scary thing, but to be honest, I try not to doom scroll about it.
Sure.
I try not to get my head too filled up with those ideas of what could happen with it. I try to be cautious of it. That's why I think if we have to use AI to enhance a few things, I kind of get that, preserving some stuff with like AI, with Wizard of Oz. But when we use AI to completely transform the Wizard of Oz to be something different, I'm a little more hesitant to celebrate it.
That sphere thing messed me up a little bit.
It's an incredible idea that was done very poorly in my eyes.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. It looks like it's a pretty fascinating experience, but knowing the behind the scenes of what they used for it and the alternative, I much rather would have seen a production done by like a team of like 100 people that put all those effects in place.
Yeah.
And not just AI give me a background of Munchkin Land.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't... God, this is turning into a whole AI episode.
But see, isn't that kind of it, though? Like, with, when we talk about lost media, like, we're putting a focus on, like, creating more things, when in reality, we could have preserved the original.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. When I saw the footage of the sphere, Wizard of Oz, there's that moment where Dorothy is talking to Annie M, and they, since they're widening the scope of the scene, you can see what... oh, God, I wish I forgot his name... But the guy who ends up being the lion or the Tin Man or whatever, you see him in the side of the frame just kind of standing there, which his character would have been doing, like, I don't know, plot-wise. It's just the camera wasn't focused on him.
Right.
But him standing in that corner was completely AI-generated because obviously they didn't film him doing that. If that becomes the version of the Wizard of Oz that everybody sees, I know it's not a big deal, but it is. It's weird to me. He's not there. He didn't film that scene. What are we doing?
It's different.
Yeah.
Right? Because if I take my niece to go see that, that's Wizard of Oz to her now.
Right.
So if she watches it at home, she's going to be like, this isn't the version that I watched.
Yeah. Why are we so zoomed in?
Yeah, exactly. And why isn't it happening all over the room and everything? So it's a really good enhancement, accompaniment thing of like, well, hey, you love The Wizard of Oz, right? What if you see this thing that's like supposed to kind of accompany it but not replace it? My fear is that someone would try and replace it with that.
Yeah.
And that's where it gets dangerous. I think we can all have our little circus sideshow stuff and do, you know, the enhanced version of Citizen Kane or whatever that looks like. Fine. If you don't like it, don't support it. But when it starts to replace it, I'd be very upset.
Yeah, and it's hard because as a counter argument, I would say that the existence of it has the potential to replace that film.
Sure. I would prefer AI don't touch my movies. That's what I would say.
I totally agree with you.
My movies. I don't own them. But like I love the movies and I don't really want to see a touch up that much. I still think that the reason these things mean so much to us, and this harkens back to the first Zero episode we did, that it's an amazing feat that human life can pull this off.
Yeah.
That like we can work together as a team and it's not the director and it's not the producer. That it is everyone coming together to do this instead of just telling a computer to do it, right? And then touching up on the back end. So the human element of it, flaws and all, I think makes it perfect. The imperfections make it perfect. So I would prefer it stay that way, but you and I aren't in control. We're here for the ride.
So as the final, before we wrap up then, bringing it back to The Patriot, if we had the potential to throw the summarization of The Patriot into an AI, into Sora or whatever, and say, hey, bring this movie back.
Right.
Would you rather it stay lost, or would you like to see a version of that?
I think it depends on whether the current quarter footage that exists in the world of this is used.
Yeah.
I don't think that I would want to see AI guess the rest of the 75% of this movie. I think if it was used as an enhancement tool of like, you know, hey, what would this look like? Okay, well, let's have our team work on that to see like the logistics behind that and not just accept it as is. I think if the script was flipped and it was 75% of the movie was kept, but they lost 25% and they used AI to kind of enhance the other parts, maybe. But I wouldn't want them to enhance the performances. I wouldn't want them to change much about it. So probably not. One thing that I thought about here is that, you know, I dogged on it at the very beginning of this episode, but you and I, when we talk about, you know, our love for film and like how we don't want to see AI affected, at the end of the day, we may have been bad friends. We may have been bad lovers.
Oh.
But we have been patriots. In the name of preserving.
Damn.
I think that canonically this means we died, though. So this would have to be our last episode.
Well, that's unfortunate.
I think we have another episode to record here.
Yeah. Man, when you were saying the line, I forgot that existed. And I was like, what did I do? I was so worried. I was like, no, I'm sorry. That line did I forget his birthday?
No, that's a real thing.
Yeah. Man, what an ending. See, I think it works. You were bashing it earlier. I think that was perfect.
Yeah, I'm
beautiful. You know delivery.
What? I'll lovingly bash things, and then when I'm actually not happy with something, that's when I really mean it. So
good,
Patriot. Wish I'd known you a little bit better.
Yeah, maybe one day. Maybe they'll find it in like
hopefully.
I don't know. Hopefully Susan we'll Sarandon's back, bathroom, or
and
something.
We'll remake this episode when it's available. I'm sorry. Did you say Susan Sarandon's bathtub?
I said bathroom.
Oh, okay.
It's probably not in the tub. I hope not, but I don't know. They find these things in the weirdest places, but. Anyway,
make sure you're checking your bathtubs out there, celebrities, everybody. Just in case a rare 75% cut of the Patriot film reel is in there.
You jest, but you wait and see. Guys, that's going to do it for this episode. A little bit different than what we have been doing, but such is the nature of lost media, I guess. And if this episode never comes out, you know why. I lost it. Next week, we're going to be covering... Or next week, we're going to write the schedule.
The next episode.
There you go. You're so good with words. We'll be covering In Old Arizona. It's going to be our first Western of the show.
It is. You excited? And it's going to be our first full talkie of... Oh, my God. Of the whole series so far.
Yeah.
I was going to say of the year, but of the series.
I'm excited for that. It's nice to hear people talk. Right, guys? Out there listening?
Can you imagine if there was a portion of this podcast where you and I were just on the other side of the room? And you could barely hear us.
You know.
Anyways, tune in next week for In Old Arizona.
Yeah, I was going to go off on a tangent, but we'll save that for next time. If you'd like to support the show, check out patreon.com/OUTAO podcast. And if you'd like to send in any thoughts on lost media, what lost film or lost experience from your childhood, not experience, movie or TV show, do you want to see rediscovered? Shoot us an email at outaopodcast@gmail.com.
And don't be afraid to go on our Instagram for this episode and share comments. And you can comment there as well in case you don't have an email for some reason. You should get one.
I don't think you could have social media without an email, Ryan.
Oh, God.
That's going to do it for this week's episode. As always, I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm Ryan.
And we'll see you at the movies.